Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome to The Shift, the podcast that aims to tell the no-holds-barred truth about being a woman post 40, created and hosted by me, journalist and author Sam Baker. My guest today is the writer Helen Garner, and I'm pretty sure that right now you're either going, "I love her," or looking a bit vague. Because despite being one of Australia's greatest living writers, Helen is surprisingly little known here. But not for much longer. Because at the age of 81, she is finally about to see almost all of her books in print in the UK and the US for the first time. Born in 1941 in Geelong, Victoria, the eldest of six, Helen has lived a fascinating life, and one that has found its way into her 13 books. Her debut, Monkey Grip, published in 1977 when she was a single mother, is still in print today, almost 50 years later. Her second novel, The Children's Bark, which is where I recommend you start if you've never read her, has been compared with Hemingway and Fitzgerald, no less. And her true crime classic, This House of Grief, has been declared one of the best books of the 21st century. Not bad for a regular kid from, as she puts it, an ordinary Australian home, not many books and not much talk.
In my family, there were five girls and one boy. And I was the eldest. And so I sort of, you know, as the eldest, one always has to sort of smash their way out of what the setup is.
I was lucky enough to get to chat with Helen and her chooks from her home near Melbourne. In fact, she kept me up way past my bedtime as we discussed the difficult father-daughter relationship, making peace with the older generations, and the emotional impact of being a war baby. She also told me why getting married a fourth time would have been the definition of madness, how she couldn't give a shit about the withdrawal of the erotic gaze, and why grandmothering has been the greatest pleasure of her life. Oh, thank you so much for agreeing to do this, and I hope you didn't have to get up too early to do it.
No, I always wake up early. You know, when you get old, you don't sleep very well, but this is a very annoying fact. I wake up about 4:30. Even if I go to bed about 10:30 and wake up at 4:30. Oh, see, I've got chickens, chooks, in the backyard. Mm-hmm. The first thing I have to do every morning is go out there and let them out and give them something to eat. So I sometimes wonder if I didn't have chickens, I might sleep longer. But it's too late now. Depend on me.
Do they, I mean, is that what wakes you up? Can you hear them?
No, I think I'm woken up by a sense of duty of keeping some creature alive.
Have you always been woken up by a sense of duty?
I think I just naturally wake up early, but, you know, I'm one of those annoying people who can't sleep in. In the days when I used to go out drinking and dancing, I still couldn't sleep in. But then I think, yeah, once you have a kid, you know, you've got to be alert. And because now I've got grandchildren, but they're enormous teenagers, so I can't blame them for anything.
Well, they may be waking you up when they come in.
Yeah. Yes, that would be a nuisance. Yeah.
Do you live with them next door? How's it work? You're very close to them, aren't you?
Well, I live actually next door, and they when 20 years ago, maybe 23 years ago, they bought this house that they live in now, and they needed to do some work on it before they could move in. So at that stage, I lived in another suburb about half an hour's drive away, and they said, can we come and – I lived in just me in a big empty house. And they said, can we come and stay with you for 6 months while we fix up our new house? And they had a little baby and everything, so I thought, hooray, this is going to be great. And it was. You know, so they moved in, but naturally it took more like 2 years for them to do the work on the house. And by that time, we never quarrelled. We never fell out. Nothing ever went wrong. We had a wonderful time. The baby was attached to me, so that when they finally moved to this house, she was furious with me, as if I'd left. She wouldn't speak to me for a week. My dad had moved into a little house that was for sale next door to my other house over in the other suburb. So he lived there next door to me for about 2 years, and then he died. But on the very day he died, my daughter and her husband's next-door neighbour put her head over the fence and said, I'm going to sell my house. And they ran to the phone and called me up and said, quick, come and buy the look at the house, and if you buy it, you can sell the other one and buy this one. So we had the two houses side by side, and they're quite close together. So we just made a hole in the wall and put a little hallway across. And so in effect, it's one big house, but there is a sense of privacy.
So you can still shut the door on them at least.
Yeah, I can shut the door, or I can lock the door if I want to.
You can lock it, that's right.
Yeah.
Did you say your dad had moved in next door to you?
No, he did years ago.
Yeah, when you were in your other house.
When I was in the other house, that's 20 years ago, yeah. Yeah, he did, but I never got on well with my father. When you don't get on with a parent, there's something triangular going on with the. So I think people find sometimes that when one parent dies, you get on much better with the surviving one than you ever have before. And that's what happened with me and Dad. I mean, he was a kind of grouchy old bastard, and I'd had to fight him. You know, I was the oldest of kids, and I had to fight him for most of my life. And I don't know, when Mum died, he just sort of became a nicer person. And we used to go out for a coffee in the morning, and we were always laughing. You know, it surprised me.
So do you think, having been estranged from your dad and then your mum dying, did that make you feel like, I need to make this right before he dies?
It greatly troubled me that I had this bad relationship with my father, and I used to try various ways of making it right long before Mum died. And one time I said to him, well, how about we go on a trip? Why don't we drive to what was then called Ayers Rock, Uluru, in the middle of the country. Why don't we drive up there, just the two of us? And he goes, oh, okay. So we drove up there. But it was, how do you straighten things out with, especially a father, a man of his generation, can't talk about anything, has no name for anything, you know, psychological thinking unknown. By the time we got to Uluru, I was just about ready to get on a chopper and fly out of there. They weren't available. But I don't know. It was worth doing. He didn't even get out of the car when we got to the rock. He just sat there looking grumpily out the window.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And as it happened, I was the one who was in the room in the hospital at the moment that he died. Everyone else had gone out to get something to eat. And I thought, no, I think I'll stay here. And they were hardly out the front door of the hospital before he breathed his last. And I felt this was a great gift by fate. I mean, I don't think he was out of it. You know, he'd had a heart attack in the morning and died that night. And I just did feel an enormous sort of blessing that I was there when he died. It's hard to even describe why or how those things work themselves out.
What had been the divide between you? Was it just because he was the kind of dad who couldn't cope with girls growing up and wanting to live a different life?
In my family, there were 5 girls and 1 boy, and I was the eldest. And so I sort of, you know, as the eldest, one always has to sort of smash their way out of what the setup is. And education was another thing. I mean, he left school at 15 and I went to university, and I was probably a real pain in the butt, you know, in those years. But I think what it is, I think he really loved me. I never felt that he didn't love me. And I think he loved me in a way that made him jealous. He stuffed up things in my life where he was so horrible to any man that I got involved with. I mean, it was blatantly obvious that he was jealous, but he wasn't the kind of guy who could name it, or you can talk about things like that. My mother was one of, I think, 7 children. And she had a younger brother, her youngest brother, she was loved deeply and was very, very fond of. And he died in the war. He was in the Air Force, and he was, I think he was about 19 or something, and his plane got shot down and over Germany. And when the news of this came to my mother, I would have been 18 months old. You know, she never talked about the emotional pain of it or anything. We just knew for a fact that Uncle Noel had died. So many years later, like, I mean, about 1,000 years later, when I was grown up, just a few years ago, I went with some friends of mine to the War Museum in Canberra, and I was expecting, you know, dusty old tanks and stuff like that, but it was very modern, and they said, you know, if you want any information about any of your family, anyone you know who's been in the armed forces, just go up to that desk and ask that person there. So I went over and I said, can you give me some information about Noel Gadsden? See, it was a strange and unusual name. So he just sort of turned around to the computer, went boom, 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 like this, turned back with a sheet of paper. And on the paper was a photo of him and his crew and the plane and the dates. And when I saw that date, a kind of bomb went off in my head. I thought, okay, where does that fit into our lives? I would have been 18 months old. My next sister, the second child, would have been a tiny, tiny baby. They lived in a different town from Mum's family. Mum came from Melbourne, and they lived in a town called Geelong, which is about an hour's drive away. And so she didn't have her family sort of nearby. And I thought, she must have been just poleaxed with grief. But she had to deal with a baby and a toddler. And I thought, Dad must have had to pick up some of the slack. I mean, Dad must have had to take me on. And I must have been the first child that he ever was in a really close, dependent, loving relationship with, and a sort of number one for the child. And I said to a friend of mine who happens to be a psychoanalyst, but we were just in a knitting group together, and I was telling his story, and I said, and he must have had to comfort me. And she said, and Helen, you must have had to comfort him. And I'm just going, boom, 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 all these bombs are going off. And I sort of, this is after he was dead that all this happened. And I just felt enormous tenderness for him and for her. And my whole attitude towards them was transformed just by seeing the date of when that man died in the war. And I just think that, you know, I've read a lot of novels. It's amazed me that I'd never given that post-war thing or that during-the-war thing. This was in 1942. No, what am I saying? It must have been 44, so I was nearly 2. And so it's a kind of wartime story. And I never thought of myself in that way before. You know how people put them, you're encouraged to put yourself into a generation that's got a name. And everyone goes on and on in Australia about the baby boomers who are post, but I think, you know, I'm older than that. I'm not a baby boomer. I'm whatever the other sort is called. I guess that all sorts of emotional relationships are formed in families at times of great public and political stress that we don't know about.
And that generation, I wouldn't say particularly men, but actually women, they didn't talk about stuff, did they? They didn't talk about feelings and...
No, and they didn't have the language for it. And I think we sometimes underestimate how deeply we are dyed by psychology and psychological thinking, that really in my parents' generation it was sort of unknown to the average person. There was no language for it, and most language about emotions was kind of moral language, and it duty language, which gets us back to what we were talking about before. Just, you know, okay, your brother's been killed in the war, you've got a baby, man up, you know, get real, you've got to look after this baby, and your grief schmief, you know, everybody's sad, everybody's lost someone.
What we call generational trauma now is something that they would have just gone, oh. But all of those things, I mean, he must have been so shaped by that, and their relationship must have been shaped by the things they didn't know about each other. And your relationships, obviously, with them, shaped up by that, what they'd been through. What was young Helen like?
I mostly remember just reading. I was one of those kids who just read. I read and I read and I read and more and more. There were so many of us, you know, and we just, every 18 months, every 2 years, boom, 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 there's another baby. And I don't remember there ever being a baby in the house. I've managed to repress all that. I don't remember. Until my brother was born when I was 10, you know, I sort of never seen a baby boy before, and this was interesting, and I remember him vividly. But I mean, in all those years, I must have had to change a nappy, or I must have had to, you know, give a baby a bottle. Yeah, but I've got no memory of it at all. But I think that's what happens to eldest children in big families. You, step by step, you get your every couple of years, you're one step further away from your mother, and she's too. And she's got a new one, and you're just kind of left on the shore over there. I do know that my next younger sister always had lots of friends. They were always running in and out of the house, and you know, they lived over the back, and the kids in the neighbouring houses she was very friendly with. And I don't remember having those sort of relationships. I really think that once I discovered reading, that was what my life was about. And I was smart, you know, I was good at school and did well, and I didn't have any problems there. So do you remember yourself, what you were like as a child?
Not much. I mean, I would probably say something very similar to what you've just said, really. Not with less children, I've only got a brother, but I would probably say, you know, I was very much about the books and quite introverted, and I didn't love school because school was, I was a swotty kid, so it wasn't the lessons, but it was the you know, being a swotty kid didn't make you friends.
Well, yeah, this could be me. I was no good at sport. Sport was what you had to do here. And my next sister down, she was kind of long-legged and athletic and could do high jump and things like that. And
how annoying.
Really was actually terribly annoying. And she used to, I remember she was kind of vain about it, and she used to, you know, when you have to do a high jump, you have to like pause and then run in a particular way. Well, she, if anyone spoke in the people watching while she was, you know, preparing herself for this run, she'd look around with this look of anger and contempt on her face. She died 20 years ago. It's funny when you get to this age, people just die. They just turn around and disappear. It's quite shocking.
Just one of the many, I was reading your brilliant essay, The Insults of Age.
I'm so glad I wrote that.
it's so good. I enjoyed it so much. And I mean, that's just one of the many insults. I actually wrote down something that I want to get on a t-shirt. Oh, it really is astonishing how much shit a woman will cop in the interests of civic and domestic order.
Thanks, I'm so pleased you like it. I'm just amazed at how many people have spoken to me about that essay. I just loved writing it. I felt so gleeful. And, you know, some people say, oh, she's the kind of person who's mean to waiters.
No, it's like he was the kind of waiter who saw two middle-aged women and put them at the back in the dark. I mean, yeah. Frankly. I think it depends how old you are when you read that essay, whether you recognise that or not. How old do you think you were when you stopped copping shit in the interest of order?
Pretty old, actually. I still have, you know, that girly sort of instinct in many situations. And sometimes I don't obey that instinct, and I really kind of shock myself. I mean, I get a fright when I hear myself speak sharply. I was in a shop recently. This is a very tiny incident. I was in a menswear shop, and I was trying to buy some hankies. I wanted some big hankies. And I'm looking at the hankies, and this boy who was, you know, like about 19 or something comes ostensibly to serve me. And he wouldn't look at me. You know, I was saying, have you got any more of these? And he'd be saying, no, I don't think so. And he was totally bored. And a certain moment I just said to him, I snapped. I just burst out. I said, eye contact. What? And I said, you have to give me eye contact. And
but you scared the living daylights out of him.
You should have seen the look on his face. He was so furious, and he, you know, he was a sort of cool youth, a gilded youth. And I think that's what, you know, people always say, oh, the erotic gaze is withdrawn for women, blah, blah. I wouldn't give a shit about the erotic gaze. What I'm interested in is just human contact gaze. And to be deprived of that is that's sort of deathly. The whole thing about, you know, whether blokes think you're, you know, fuckable or attractive anymore, he's of no interest to me. You know, I'm well over that line and past it. But I do feel sort of wounded by the withdrawal of eye contact from any human being. You know, this is not about men and women. And I make a point of, you know, I look back and I think about how I have withheld eye contact in situations where the person might have been lonely or just human being there, and I've, you know, sailed past on my merry way. And I, that's one thing I really love about going to a small town is that people greet you in the street, just a nod. You know, you don't have to say hello, how are you going, but just acknowledge that the other person exists and is near you.
Yeah, Barbara Kingsolver, when she came on the shift, she was saying that about where she lives versus cities. And the, you know, the way that, how does she, I think it's the way, I don't know whether, have you read Demon Copperhead?
I haven't read her, and she's a person, she's one of my gaps in my reading, and so many people have mentioned her recently that I know that I'm going to have to rectify this ASAP.
Yeah, you're going to have to read Demon Copperhead. But he talks, and I think this is probably her, actually, as opposed to him talking about when you're in cities, you don't get any juice from people. So your humanity doesn't get topped up because there's no interaction, which is kind of what you're saying. And as you get older, I think as a woman, that stops, like you say, that male gaze thing. But have you found that it's stopped from other people as well as you've got older again?
Yes, I remember when I split up with my third husband and last husband, which is 25 years ago, I moved into a big apartment block in a different suburb of Sydney that I didn't know, and it was kind of a rather not exactly posh suburb, but there were people there who thought well of themselves. So I wasn't trying to make friends with anyone in the building. I mean, I was too out off the planet with misery to care about anything, any extended contact. But I noticed all these gorgeous young women dressed in expensive suits and everything would set out for work, and I would go out early for a walk, and I'd be coming back in the front door of the building, and all these young women would come striding out, and they would just completely ignore me. And I found this devastating because I was so sad and just so obliterated by the end of the marriage. And I just couldn't. I thought, oh, here comes a person. I automatically thought I'll say hello, because I came from a part of town which was a bit more sort of hip, you know, and people would speak to each other. But so I actually forced the issue. You know, I'd say, good morning, you know, rather firm. And they'd resentfully say hello as they went strode past in their stilettos.
So when you split up with your third husband, were you in your mid-50s?
Yeah, let's see. What if you feel? I was about 56, I think, yeah.
What made you decide that the third one was the last one?
Oh, I thought, I've tried this 3 times. I've blown it, or it has been blown by both of us 3 times. And I just thought, I think that really I've had enough. I you know that thing, that saying that that's a definition of insanity when you keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. Well, that's me in marriage, and I had a terrible sense of sorrow and failure, and I mean I was furious with him. You know, he cheated on me and lied to me and all the, you know, the usual. But I was sort of devastated by, I thought, I am really hopeless at this and I'll never be any good at it, so I'm not going to try it again. And I didn't, and so I've been on my own ever since then. So when I came back to Melbourne about 2 years after that breakup, I'm afraid I've left out something important. My daughter phoned me up from Melbourne and said, we're having a baby. You can come home now. So I thought, oh, someone needs me. And so I just packed up and went south. You know, I came home to Melbourne. And so that was the first step. And the next step was when they needed to, what I was telling you before about the houses, when they came in and they said, can we come and live with you for a while? I thought, oh, someone wants to live with me. I couldn't believe it. You know, I was so demoralized and so diminished by that third marriage that I just did feel like a very small piece of shit for quite a long time. And just gradually, my daughter kind of saved me. But it was, she saved me by helping me get into a situation where I was useful. She needed me, that's what I'm saying. I could see that I could serve and that I had skills that I could offer and experience. I made money, you know, I was working, so I had money. So if in emergencies I was useful with the dough. So these years of being a grandmother have been the most wonderfully happy years of my life.
I don't know whether you've read about it, but I'm sure you've got much better things to do. There's a thing doing the rounds at the moment. It just started on TikTok, and it's about the sign that your relationship is good is whether or not your partner will peel an orange for you, apparently. And I did just think, wow, how mean do you have to be to refuse to peel an orange for someone?
Yes, that would be pretty mean, wouldn't it?
That would really be really mean. I was, you just mentioned the dough. And I can't remember because I've read so many things that you've written in the last couple of days. I can't remember where I read it. But I read you said one of your husbands described you as a hardworking little money-making machine.
That was my third husband, in fact.
It made me want to punch him, to be honest.
Yes. Well, it is kind of it gave me a shock when he said that, and I thought, I don't know if he meant it as an insult. See, I mean, he was really a fanatical worker. He was a guy who, as a writer, I mean, as a guy who had to work every day. I had always made a living by freelance journalism. So I always had a little job on. You know, I was always reviewing something or interviewing someone or going out to another town and doing a piece about someone. So I was always on the move, whereas his way of working was to shut himself in a room, in a flat, to which I had no access during the day, and drive himself. He drove himself. So, you know, he would see someone like me as this kind of a flibbertigibbet, someone who was always doing something different. And, you know, into the painful time when we were splitting up, I think I sort of set myself up for an insult, I guess. I said, "Do you think I'm lazy?" And he said, "No. No, I think you're a hardworking little money-making machine." And that's fine. I mean, what's wrong with that? That's how I made a living. And I was kind of proud of it. You know, I was proud. You know, I mean, I've never been in a newsroom, but I thought of myself as a journalist in the sense that I could, you know, barge into situations and make something of them.
I mean, you've written, you know, award-winning nonfiction. I mean, your fiction's phenomenally successful as well, but like this House of Grief, and is it that about you that you just described, that going places, you know, seeing yourself more as a journalist, do you think that's why you tend to veer more to nonfiction than fiction?
It could be, but I do also think that I unconsciously moved off the turf of our rivalry as writers. But also, I never had that feeling that he had of the novel as being the apex of everything and what you aimed at, and that was what, if you could write, that's what you should be writing, was the novel. And I thought, yeah, I mean, novels are wonderful and they're great to read and important and terrifically enjoyable and, you know, hard to write. I don't know, it's when I did shift over to, I didn't think, okay, I'm not going to write another novel. I'm just going to be a journalist. It was never like that. Because the work came up and I followed it. I followed the trail each time where it led. A few years later, I looked around and I thought, I got off the territory. I backed off it. So that's, and I don't feel badly about that now. Because when I got to do nonfiction, it suited me. I remember sitting in court and following a long trial and sitting in court and thinking, I am completely happy. I'm content to be here. I'm good at this. I know what I'm doing. And it was just for that split second of feeling it. It was a wonderful happiness.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
I've just finished a book, and it's nonfiction, but it's about. It's an account of My youngest grandchild is a boy, and he was playing in the Australian rules football. He plays, and he plays in it for the local footy club. It's called footy here to distinguish it from football, i.e. soccer. He was in the under 16s, and I had no work and I didn't know what to do, and I just published all those diaries, and I was feeling a bit sort of wrung out. And I thought, what can I write about? I wish I was writing something. And I thought, oh, I could write about Ambrose is his name, Ambrose's footy season. And I'd never paid any attention to his footy all these years while he was just, you know, slogging around as a little boy. And I said to him, can I come to your footy training? He goes, why? I said, I don't know. I'm just bored. I haven't got anything to do. I'm at a loose end. And he goes, oh, okay. So I started going, and I used to drive him to training twice a week. Well, so the book consists of, you know, accounts of footy, training and matches, but also conversations between me and my grandson.
You're pretty varied, aren't you? I mean, yeah, the children's book is very different from, you know, this House of Grief and the diaries. And so, you know, I was going to ask you, because you're, you know, one of five sisters and you had a daughter. Has it been an eye-opener being hands-on grandmother to boys?
Oh, very much so. And that's one of the things that I made me want to write this footy book, was just to sort of have a look at that, you know, to try and articulate it. I do have one brother, but he was a lot younger than me, and so we were never children together. I learned about how fragile boys can be and how their fragility and their sort of delicacy, the things that they have to kind of crush in themselves or hide in order to cut it out there in the world. Their imaginative worlds are different from girls' ones. And I spent a lot of time as a grandmother playing. We played a lot. You know, we had make-up games I just followed them. We used to have games like hotels. I was thinking about this the other day, about playfulness. Children to me are the most interesting thing in the world. They're so battling, you know, they're fighting their way into the world, and they have to come up with tactics and strategies, and they have to ponder about things and endure things while they're being sort of shaped by their circumstances. And I mean, this, just being a grandmother has taught me so much.
Oh, it sounds fascinating, I think. It strikes me that playfulness and being open to that and alive to that is quite important as you grow older, that it's the people who are open to that and alive to kind of curiosity and open to things who are the people who find aging easiest.
Yeah, I hope you're right about that, because I mean, there's all sorts of different, there are different sorts of play. Evelyn Waugh said, conversation seriously pursued consists of narrative alternating with comment. And I think that's a really wonderful definition, because I really love it when people say, guess what happened? This is what happened. And they tell you a great story, and then you just have fits of laughter or tears, whatever, and then you start to analyze it. And that to me is serious play. I think that kind of play is, there's a critic here called Peter Craven, and he once wrote about what he called the deep moral value of fun, which is a phrase I also greatly enjoy thinking about. Being with kids is fun, but it's kind of serious fun. You know, it's fun with meaning and point. And I don't know what I'm going to do when they all grow up and move away. You know, sometimes I have these noble fantasies. I think, oh, perhaps I could foster a child. And I think, no, I don't. I think probably that might be a situation where you do need a husband.
Yeah. How does it feel for you? Because you must have written Monkey Grip when you were a single mum with a little toddler or a, you know, How does it feel to see that book that you wrote in that circumstance almost 50 years ago, not just still in print, but, you know, in print in more countries than ever before, cult classic, being read by a whole new generation?
Astonishing. I really can hardly believe it. When all this recent stuff happened where my backlist gets sold into the UK and to the United States, I thought, this can't be happening. Is this really happening? I thought people are still reading Monkey Grip. And I just don't know how this has come about. I'm very happy about it. But by the same token, you know, Monkey Grip is kind of a bit mortifying to me because it's all full of sex and drugs and all those things that are so far in the past for me, I can hardly even remember them. I find that really strange. I know there are some writers who kind of despise where they come from, and people who are enormously, enormously well-read in difficult European literature, for example. Australia kind of really flat and boring and unsophisticated and not worthy of one's attention unless critically or unless making. What I didn't want to do was to write about Australia as a spectacle for people who weren't Australian, and I wouldn't know how. Firstly, it's not just that I thought, oh, I won't do that because it's not a good thing. I just knew that. See, I'm pretty ignorant of history. I really am. I've got a big blank there, and I don't have a huge vision of the world and where Australia sits in it and politically, blah, blah, blah. You know, I mean, all those things, if people write about them well, are fabulous. But it's not my thing. It's not something I could do. And I kind of bristle a bit about people who despise this country. And in a way that limits me because, for example, I find Shirley Hazzard pretty hard to take on those grounds. You know, just the sense that she couldn't get out fast enough and get into an international world and live in a country which is beautiful. It's been beautiful for millennia. And I realised that by having that hostility towards her or writers like her, I've actually missed what's brilliant about her. That's something I can now rectify, I think.
I could talk to you all night, but sorry, night for me, morning for you. I better ask you the questions I always ask at the end. What is your emotional age?
I'll just answer off the top of my head, 37. That's the sort of thing, you know, if someone said, oh, if you went back in time, and what age would you like to be at? And I might say 37 because you can still go out dancing and all that kind of stuff. No, I think my emotional age is a lot older than that now, and a jolly good thing too. I think it's probably, I think my emotional age is probably about 75, yeah, where you actually know quite a lot, but you're not dead yet and your hearing hasn't packed up and your eyesight's still not too bad and you can still ride a bike without falling off and you know that you've got a realistic idea about friendship and love and what they are, what it's foolish to expect from yourself because you're sure to be disappointed.
Give us a book recommendation.
I'll tell you what, a book that I really love and go back to, and that's True Grit by Charles Portis. Have you ever read it?
No.
Oh, look, it's just wonderful. Talk about voice. I mean, it's really a marvellous, marvellous book. I wrote him a fan letter about 2 years ago, but I think he might have already been dead. Anyway, he didn't. Yeah, I love that. She's such a marvellous character, the girl who hires it. Kind of cowboy hitman to get revenge on the man who killed her father. It's just the most, it's sort of hilariously wonderful. I couldn't praise it enough.
What advice would you give younger women?
What advice? Well, I could give advice. This is the kind of advice that makes you unpopular and get you, mark you down as a feminist. Don't allow yourself to get helplessly drunk in a public place. I think, and don't think your rights will protect you if you do.
Mm. Yeah, that has got you in trouble before, hasn't it?
I'm sticking to that one. There was a terrible, terrible thing that happened here. A young woman a couple of years ago was walking home from the city at night by herself, and she walked across a park. Unbeknown to her, she was being followed by this nutcase, and he raped and killed her. And it was there was a great outpouring of grief and rage. And as usual, the police said what I think is a reasonable thing to say. They said, please, we beg you, don't walk across the park, or don't walk around by yourself at 2 o'clock in the morning, because we can't protect you. We can't. There's a law, you have rights, but we can't protect you. And I've argued with my, even with my daughter and my granddaughter. I say, well, you know, I can, when people say, oh, the police, they always say that sort of thing, and it's so outrageous, and it's not us that have to change, it's men who have to change. And that seems to me like holding, you know, standing in the middle of a pedestrian crossing, holding up a hand to a 10-ton truck that's coming towards you. I think that's what the police in their clumsy way are saying. People get you know, nasty moments at the dinner table if you express that view. Anyway, I'm expressing it here with 100% conviction, if I may.
You may. Have you had a nasty moment with your daughter and granddaughter at the dinner table?
Oh, I wouldn't say it was nasty, but we just disagreed. You know, they say, oh, no, but so, you know, you're giving up. That's defeatist. That's rah-rah. Yeah, that doesn't make sense to me.
Who is your old bird role model?
I used to know this old woman in Sydney. Her name was Lady Maisie Drysdale, and oh, she was terrific. I loved her. She was completely sort of, she was like a big old duchess. You know, she was so genial and funny, and she was, you know, she was the widow of a very famous artist, and she had a terrifically honed bullshit detector, and she was filled with genial, hilarious sweetness that I greatly admired. But I often wonder if the old bird thing is to do with clothes and self-presentation, in which case I would say I have a model, not a model, but someone who has affected me in this way, and that is someone who I otherwise have no particular admiration for, and that's Patti Smith. But Patti Smith is younger than me, obviously, but, well, I think she is. She was present at an event in the United States that I was part of, and she was going to give the the sort of keynote speech that night. And we all went along to the sound check, and she turns up for the sound check wearing what you would wear if you were just going out into your backyard to do a bit of weeding. You know, she just had these old pants on and a kind of jacket, and on her head she had a knitted beanie, and she had these two little limp grey plaits hanging down.
I love her so much. Yeah.
And she had boots, just, you know, ordinary battered looking boots on. And I looked and I thought, wow, she's just coming from the backyard. And so she did the sound check. Night falls, the event starts, she turns up wearing exactly the same clothes, and the rest of us going, oh, I'm going to put on a little jacket. And she just gave her speech dressed like someone who was at home. And I was bowled over by this. I thought, I'm going to try and I would like to be that relaxed to just think, okay, I'm here to talk. Let's talk. And this is what I've got to say. Not this is what I own, or this jacket makes me look thinner. I'm not wearing my diamond necklace. I was inspired by her.
Yeah, she's so just herself, isn't she?
Yeah.
Take it or leave it. What's your superpower?
My superpower is grammar and punctuation. I'm really good at those, and I'm very offendable.
And last one, how many fucks do you give?
I give a lot of fucks about things that need fucks given. As a general principle, I would like to apply the Patti Smith approach to number of fucks given. Yeah, that's actually a terribly interesting question. I'll have to think more about that, and I will. Well, you've got to make a decision about what fucks to give, don't you? I mean, there's no time. There's no time. And there's a lot of them that don't deserve to be given, and they change as you get older. Yeah.
Thank you, Helen. I've had the best evening talking to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much. I had no idea we were going to have so much fun.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy The Shift and would like to show your appreciation, why not buy me a coffee? Go to www.buymeacoffee.com/theshiftwithsambaker. You can hear a new episode of The Shift every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please do rate, review, follow, tell your friends, because it really does help other people find us. And if you'd like to know more about my own experience of shifting, my book, The Shift, How I Lost and Found Myself After 40, and You Can Too, is out now in paperback.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.